Well, hello, everybody. Welcome back to Two Legs. This is episode 210, and boy, this is a real special one. I'm one of your two co-hosts, Andy Nichols, and joining me is the founding member of Two Legs, Mr. Thomas Hunyadi. Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon, Andy. And I tell you, we're really excited about this episode here today. Really looking forward to it.
This is a real celebrated interview, and we are so happy and delighted to welcome Mr. Chris Welch to Two Legs. Hello, Chris. Happy to have you on.
Oh, hi, Tom. Hi, Andy. Glad to be here.
We are. That's how we do it. And Chris Welch is the celebrated rock media journalist royalty, if there ever was one. Chris has written over 40 books on a myriad of musicians in his career. We're going to get to some of that today, but obviously we are mainly a Paul McCartney show. So we are going to be mainly featuring, talking eventually about his book that he wrote about Paul, which is called Paul McCartney, The Definitive Biography, which was published in 1984. But Chris, as we've mentioned at the start, has worked and covered all sorts of musicians from the UK from the heyday in the 60s into the 70s, traveling with Wings and Yes. And we're going to also cover some of his stories with Yes as well, because he also is the author of the excellent, excellent biography, The Close to the Edge, A Story of Yes, which was first published in 1999. So, Chris, just to kick it off, what was your kind of upbringing in terms of approaches to pop music, and before you started your career as a journalist, what was your introduction to music as growing up where you did in London?
Well, I grew up in London just after the war, and my parents had a gramophone. I don't know if you remember, there was a hand cranked gramophone. And my older brother told me that there were little bands playing inside. They had two doors in front, which was the speaker. And he convinced me there was actually a small band playing inside the gramophone. So that was my made me laugh a lot.
Yeah. That's good.
We used to play these battered 78 records, and one of them was by a British ukulele player who's George Harrison's favorite artist, which is George Formby. I don't know if you remember George Formby or you've heard of him, but great ukulele player. He was the Jimi Hendrix of the ukulele, actually. And we had this record, Tiger Rag, and it was an instrumental, no vocals. And that was my introduction to jazz music and popular music. I just played it endlessly. It sounded so exciting. Then, of course, we listened to the radio and lots of American pop music mainly. So that was my introduction to music.
By the time of the early wave of Beatlemania, had it caught you? Were you instantly hooked by it?
But yes, just music, really. I loved, I worked on the local newspaper when I, after leaving school, I worked in Fleet Street as a copy boy, got used to working for newspapers. And then I got a job as a reporter in about 1960. And the paper I was working for was based in Bexley Heath, southeast London. And nearby was Dartford, and there was this young band coming up called the Rolling Stones, which I thought was worth writing about. So I wrote a little piece about them in my local paper. I didn't actually interview them, but I saw them playing, which was wonderful. Saw the Stones in there about 1963, playing in a tent at a festival. So R&B was happening, Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley, Rolling Stones, and I started writing about it for my local paper. And somebody said, well, you should be working for a music paper. You're into this stuff, which is really taking off. And, the Stones were in the charts. So I wrote to the Melody Maker, and they said, well, miraculously, we have a vacancy, which is quite rare for a young reporter. And I thought, oh, I used to read Melody Maker every week. It was a jazz and pop and rock paper. The Weekly News was the Bible, really, for musicians, too.
Right. It's funny you say that too, because you hear the story when you talk to you hear the story of the engineers from like EMI or whatever, and they just happened to send a letter to somebody at EMI and they got hired right on the spot. You hear a lot of that kind of thing. True. It seems like
it's important. It's funny to see how, and looking back on it now, and how the world has changed so much since then, is that the British weeklies were so important for music and musicians and producers and journalists alike. It was, as you say, the Bible, and it really was.
Yes, we were up against a lot of competition. I mean, I got the job eventually. I should say how I got the job, which was I went for the interview and they said, ah, the letter writer. I was always writing letters and winning an LP whenever I wrote a good letter and usually complaining about something. And so they recognized me, the guy who wrote all these letters. And they said, right, well, we've got the Dave Brubeck Quartet is in London this week. And the editor said, well, Dave Brubeck's in town. And Joe Morello, the drummer, is available for an interview. And nobody knows what to ask drummers. And as it turned out, I played the drums and loved drums anyway. So meeting Joe Morello was a wonderful opportunity. And I went on a Sunday night to his hotel. I was quite nervous. And he was very charming and helpful, told me how to play the sticks with the bounce, you know, or the famous Joe Morello technique. Very helpful. And he said something funny, which was, you don't have to be an idiot to play the drums, you know. I don't know who he was referring to. Somebody he didn't like. So I wrote the piece. I had to write the piece in a hurry, delivered it to the paper the next day, and they printed it amazingly with a byline. And it said, you don't have to be an idiot to play the drums. So I got the job. Thank you very much. So I always thank Joe Morello for getting me the job with
Melody Maker, which was in 1964, Chris?
Sorry?
The job you got with Melody Maker, you began with them in 1964?
Yes, 64, October 1964. I had to resign from my local paper and upset them a bit. And then my first week, guess who I interviewed the first week? Eric Clapton.
Oh, when he was with the Yardbirds,
And the Shangri-Las. Do you remember the Shangri-Las?
Sure.
So that was among my first gigs, my first jobs.
With Melody Maker. And you really, I mean, talk about fortuitous timing. They hired you right at the cusp of the explosion of everything.
It certainly was. And my job was, most of the other reporters were older and they were more into jazz. They'd been there for years. And I was the young reporter who had to cover all these mysterious groups that they didn't know much about. And like they all played at the Marquee Club in Soho, which was far from our office. We were in Fleet Street, our office. And so this was a dream job. I had to go out all night drinking and listening to rock bands. And,
well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, as you're a young interviewer, I mean, how would you prepare for someone, say, like a Clapton at that point in time?
Well, of course, papers, it was a music newspaper, and stories are quite short, relatively short. You were lucky if you got 800 words for a feature or 300 words for a review. It was before the age of Rolling Stone, you know, developed the whole art of rock journalism. But I was doing interviews, and of course, we didn't have tape recorders, and they hadn't invented the cassette tape recorder. So everything was scribbling notes, you know, and usually in a pub or a bar somewhere. And there were very rarely was it set up. You didn't have to have a passport to go and interview a band like you do now. You didn't have to have permission from the management. You just sort of saw them playing in the club. So, hey, would you like to do an interview? And, yeah, okay. So that's how I met the Yardbirds in that little coffee bar on Fleet Street. And and I used to go and see them all the time. I thought they were fantastic. And many other groups as well, because it was the height of the R&B thing happening in the wake of the Stones. So there were so many good bands in London, all over the country, actually, the Artwoods. And of course, all the people in those groups would go on to form supergroups in about 5 years later. Yeah.
Interesting.
So that's how I got to know them all, basically.
Yeah.
One of the bands I really, just tell me to stop when I'm going on too much, but.
No, please.
One of the bands I really liked was the Spencer Davis Group. And of course, Steve Winwood was there, about 18. And I remember going for a drink with him in a pub. And he said, oh, I'm allowed to drink in a pub now. I'm just old enough. But he'd been drinking in the pub for 2 years before that. So. But that was great. There was so much talent and so many great musicians. And Well, I had two jobs, really. One was to write about what was in the charts, the pop groups, and who was in the top 10. That was fun. And then writing about all these bands.
So you mentioned some of these artists. Did you ever actually get an opportunity to interview any of the Beatles or the Beatles collectively while in those days?
The Beatles, yes. I should say I did see them play before I joined Melody Maker. I was lucky to see the Beatles live at the Owen Hammersmith in Lewisham, and I had by chance I happened to be in a pub opposite the theatre that night, and we knew the Beatles were on. Oh, and the man burst into the pub, distraught, his shirt all awry, and exhausted, red in the face, and who is this guy? I'm the manager of the theatre. It's bedlam over there. It's madness, and. He said, "We want a cover of tickets." He wanted to escape, and we got over there, and the kids were just screaming the place down. I can't say I heard the Beatles, but I certainly saw them.
You're right, of course, yeah.
Right. Later on, you asked if I actually interviewed them. Well,
yes.
I met George Harrison at a party, and I interviewed John Lennon at EMI. That's right. I forget now. He might have been before, and he was quite serious. He wasn't very jokey.
Was he?
This is my job. I have to do an interview with Melody Maker. Okay, I'll answer your questions. I couldn't say we had a warm interview, John Lennon.
Wow.
And apart from that, there was a great scene in London where everybody mixed together. All the bands. After they've done a gig or might have been filming or doing TV, and they go to a string of clubs across the West End, like the Speakeasy. I don't know if you've heard of the Speakeasy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep.
Speakeasy and the Cromwellian and the La Chasse Club. And so that's where everybody hung out and drank together and talked together and then formed new bands. You know, there's lots of
clubs. Right.
I don't want to be in this group anymore. I want to join your band.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, between between the Marquee and La Chasse, can you imagine the amount of talent and future groups that came through those doors just over a couple of drinks and said, let's just do something? Could you imagine? You know, it's incredible to think about.
It really was like that. Yes, exactly how it happened. Because for a while, had you ever been to the Marquee, Andy? Did you ever get there?
No, but I've read about it, obviously, in all your books. So I know, you know, and I have spent some time in the UK, but it was long gone by the time I got over there. Yeah.
Yes, it was rather funny, really, because the club itself didn't have a license, so it couldn't sell drinks. So, and just down the road, there was this pub, The Ship, and all the bands rushed into The Ship during the intermission or before the gig, had a quick drink and rushed back again, and all gossiping went on there. I'd see Jeff Beck at the bar or the Pretty Things, or they'd all burst in. So for a few seconds, the pub would be like a lunatic asylum. Keith Moon and the
Well, you have a great photograph on your website of you and Keith Moon, which is just a great photo of you and Keith Moon. Looks like circa 1969. We'll flash it up here to show the viewers. That's a great photo. Probably around the time that Tommy came out.
Was that with me and at Keith's pub?
I believe so. Yeah, it's on your website. Yeah.
Yeah, it's on the website. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, 60s and 70s? It seemed like a lot of artists were more approachable. That's, you know, the sad day when Lennon is murdered. Did you find that a lot of it has changed after Lennon's death when it comes to, you know, interviewing artists? Or did a lot of them start putting their guard up a little bit more and maybe not as, you know, talky as they may have been prior to that?
Yes, I don't know if that particular episode was, the tragic death of John was appalling, wasn't it?
Right.
And I can remember hearing the news on the radio while I was typing a story at the time about something, a terrible shock. But, yeah, I think Altamont as well was a rather another turning point in rock that became less fun after Altamont, after that terrible scenes there. And also because in the 60s we're talking about bands that were mostly broke, they didn't have any money really. And they weren't superstars in the sense that they are now. You know, they were superstars in the Musical Express and Melody Maker on our front page, but the rest of the world weren't so familiar with Jeff Beck or Eric Clapton or Jimmy Page. we all think of great, or Yes, for that matter. But it all changed, of course, when albums started selling in huge numbers, and the whole scene changed then, when bands at last started to earn some money. Rather more than £100 a night or $100 a night for a gig. And so the whole world changed then. Rather more than tragic incidents like John's death, I think it was changing before then. It had become a big business, and the world of promoters and managers taking over.
Shifting into the early prog rock era, were you fortunate enough to witness the early Crimson tours that John Anderson speaks about when he saw in the Court of the Crimson King, the first early incarnation of Rob Fripp and Greg Lake, that's widely considered the first prog album. Did you see them perform that at that time at the Marquee Club?
I did, fortunately, yes. I was walking past the Marquee and the manager ran out into the street. He saw me walking by, Jack Barry, and he said, "Chris, you've got to come in. There's this fantastic band, King Crimson," who I'd not heard of at that point. And yes, I saw them playing live then. It was pretty incredible, yeah. 21st century schizoid man at 20 paces, you know, that close. But I was never close to King Crimson. I didn't really know. I knew Greg, of course. I never got on with Robert Fripp particularly well. I don't know why, but he was a... Yes, they were a great band. And Richard Williams, my colleague on Melody Maker, he was a great King Crimson fan, and he really knew what they were doing and was well into them. They had so many changes in personnel. As I say, I never really became a huge expert on King Crimson.
Right. But those, especially those early, those first couple of albums are tremendous. And of course, John Anderson is a vocalist on one of them, Lizard. But you mentioned Jack Barry, and Jack Barry, you talk about quite a lot in your book, Close to the Edge, A Story of Yes. Jack Barry was the manager of the Shass Club and introduced John and Chris. Isn't that right?
Yes, that's correct. Yes, he was managing, co-managing the Marquee, and he also had this bar just along the street. As I say, the Marquee Club itself didn't have a license to sell drinks at that point, anyway. They got one later. So he had this idea of, it was just above a betting shop, I think it was, which was handy for the managers of the groups, because all the managers went in and placed a bet on the horse to try and raise the money to pay the band. I think that's what was going on. Tony Stratton Smith being one of them, of Genesis. Yeah. and it became a great meeting place for all the musicians. They knew they wouldn't be pestered by the fans so much. And a lot of great groups got together there, Yes included, of course. Yeah, and I think John Anderson was famous for having been sweeping the floor when he was broke. Mm-hmm. John got him to sweep the floor. It was very small, very cramped, tiny bar, and people would burst in, and they had a record player, and they played John Anderson's records on this record player.
Before, when he was Hans Christian Andersen, isn't that right?
That's right. Yeah. Hanks used to joke about it, saying, "Oh, take that off.
Yeah.
All right, take the record off," he'd say.
Yeah, so you were quite the early champion of Yes, and you talk about it in such great detail in your book, especially the early period, obviously between 68-9 up until 73-ish or so, and you championed their records, and they obviously appreciated that. You really got to spend a lot of time with Yes. You traveled to America with them. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience, traveling with Yes and going to America and just covering them as a journalist? And in those days?
Yeah, well, I was very lucky because I saw Yes for the first time playing with supporting Cream at their farewell show at the Royal Albert Hall. I'd heard rumours about them. One of my colleagues on the MM, Tony Wilson, who's a big fan as well, and he said, "I got to hear this band, Yes." And I finally heard them at the Royal Albert Hall, which is one of the biggest venues in London. That's where they started. Started at the top.
Wow.
But I was just so impressed by, well, all of them, really, because they had a wonderful drummer, Bill Bruford, and the vocal harmonies of Chris and John, and the fact that they were doing original songs as well as covering other people's material. And it sounded like a little orchestra to me. It sounded so well rehearsed, because we were used to, well, like Cream, really, jamming three-piece blues bands with a lot of arguments going on musically. A lot of competition between the musicians, where this sounded like a cooperative. I think that was the difference. That was what made it. It wasn't a battleground. It was a joint effort to make some great, fresh, exciting music. And that's what I really liked. It reminded me of, like, in a way, of a jazz big band, because it's the jazz band drummer, just sort of the way they played together. So as soon as I saw them, I gave them a good review for that show. And then I think the next time I saw them was probably in the Marquee, but with various glowing reviews. Their manager was very pleased, Roy, and he said, oh, how would you like to come to Switzerland with the band? And it's nearly Christmas, I think. So I went to, we all flew on this British Airways propeller plane, I think it was, and it had to land in snow at the airport. I think it was Zurich or somewhere. And we were all petrified. And the pilot said, well, we're going down to take a look. We looked out the window and we're all, I was sitting next to Tony Kaye at the time. Both planes were going to land. You couldn't see, it's a snowstorm. And we went, we circled the airfield and then finally landed. And I thought, God, I wasn't used to flying at that point, I have to say.
And, right.
But they had some great big talks. And I think, yeah, it was like a small theatre that they were playing. And they had a Swiss television company and radio company. And they had they dedicated a young guy called Chris, another Chris, Swiss Chris. And he was like our linguist, took care of us. But yeah, it was great traveling with them. And that's when I got to know them. I was backstage in the dressing room watching them warm up. And that's when you detect little bits of problems between the musicians. Because, should I tell you about that? Or
Yeah, please.
Right, please. I mean, yes, we're never afraid of debating how well they were. You know, they were very serious about their music, and John Anderson in particular liked rehearsing and getting everything right. It had to be correct. It had to be good. Mm-hmm. No jamming. And, of course, Peter, their lead guitar player, Peter Banks, was given free rein for a very long solo. I think it was I See You, wasn't it? I think that was the one. And it went on and on and on. And at the end of the show, at the end of his solo, he'd throw the guitar in the air and he aimed to catch it. Sometimes he didn't, you know, crushed the floor. And there were sort of mutterings between Chris and John about this extended solo. Actually, John came to me and said, could you have a word with him about it? Could you tell him? He likes you. Can you tell him to please cut the solo a bit shorter? So, did I dare do that?
Did you?
I can't remember now. I didn't want to hurt his feelings. I enjoyed the solo. I thought it was good, but it did go on too in the context of a set. Yeah.
Peter Banks kind of always thought of himself as the next Pete Townsend, isn't that right?
That's right. Pete Townsend liked him, actually. He said he was a great guitar player. And I think Peter Banks was absolutely thrilled by that. But that was his, you know, he's quite a shy guy, and being able to go on stage and show what you could do, that was very important to him. But he didn't realize he was upsetting the rest of the group by overdoing it. It's like if you're in a band with Buddy Rich on drums, and he's going to play drum solos every night for 20 minutes, and you're a trumpet player, you know, you get fed up with that, don't you, after a while.
And this period that you're talking about with the band's history is well before they had any really success in America, really before the Yes album.
Yes, because I like their first Yes album, well, the first two albums, and but when they were issued in the States, I think their manager, Roy, had managed to get a deal with Atlantic, but they didn't really know anything about Yes in New York. They thought it was a folk group.
Yeah.
It was discovered later. I thought, who's these strange vocalists, you know, all these singers? And they didn't really get the music at all. So that didn't do too well. It wasn't until later, after Peter left and then Steve Howe joined, and that's when things took off.
Yeah, and you did travel to America with them on those, like the Yes album, Fragile?
Yes, I did. I went to, I went to the States with them. I went to Germany with them. Oh, that was another interesting flight. I don't know if you've heard of the Comet, the world's first jet airliner.
No.
The one that had it was a British invention. It had a habit of landing in the sea accidentally, so it wasn't very successful. But Yes, a Comet 4, a later version, and we flew to Berlin in this Comet, and once again we're all sitting there, you know, airsick and petrified. I was sitting next to Chris Squire this time, and I said, we're only here for the fear, which he thought was funny, because there's an English beer advert which was, we're only here for the beer, which was like
nice.
And Yes, obviously it wasn't a scheduled flight, it was a chartered flight, so it's just me and Yes flying on this Comet to Berlin. And we arrived at the airport, Tempelhof Airport, and there was the sound of machine gun fire outside as we landed. I thought, oh my God, we've just got It was still East West Germany then. It was still the Iron Curtain. So. Sorry. Third World War starting. And it turned out it was NATO having an exercise on the airport. And they were firing. Whoops.
Yeah. This is like decades before really traveling in style and everything else. I mean, this was early pioneer traveling. You know, it wasn't extravagant. I mean, it might have been viewed extravagant to people who weren't doing it, but by today's standards, you were really kind of just carrying everything yourselves and traveling everything. You know, just doing it. You know, old school. You know,
that's true. Yeah, I remember going to Holland and Belgium. And I was supporting Iron Butterfly. Do you remember Iron Butterfly?
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
American band. They got on really well together. And Iron Butterfly were impressed by Yes and their arrangements. And Yes were impressed by the guitarists and the power of the band. And especially by their PA. They had this fantastic sound system, which was actually American or New York, I think, theater PA system that they cannibalized and used for the first time with a rock band. Real power, you know, enormously powerful speakers and amplifiers. So, Yes, was so impressed they bought Iron Butterfly's rig after the show, after the tour. Yeah. That was dangerous. The thing about flying was that traveling by van was even more frightening because sometimes Chris Squire was driving the van.
For you as the journalist that's actually writing about the band and you're traveling with the band, were these one long piece or were you also sending in reviews per show or was it just one long piece?
Well, by now you see I've been championing Yes and they had started to become very successful in selling records and then they later figured in the popularity poll, Melody Maker poll. So the editor I actually nearly got fired, would you believe, by the editor for covering that first Yes trip to Switzerland because he didn't really know I was there and I should have been in the office. I've been covering this band, you know, they're really great group. And who are Yes? I don't know. And the manager had to plead with the editor, Jack Hutton, to say, no, don't fire him. It was my fault. I invited him to come to see the band and then I did the story and it was rocking and rolling. No, was it Swiss Rock and Roll with Yes? That was the song.
I've seen that.
But I didn't know that the editor was going to fire me. That was another horrible shock I discovered later. Yeah. Great, isn't it?
Moving ahead a little bit in the timeline before we make the jump to McCartney and Wings. A lot of your book, obviously you followed Yes all throughout the 70s, but it seems like your core supporting period of them really kind of goes up until about close to the edge. And then when you didn't really kind of find Tales from Topographic Oceans too warm upon release, did you really think that the band had started to change and they were not the band that you first really kind of enjoyed to champion in 68 or 69 by the time Topographic Oceans comes out? Because you know you've talked about it quite a bit in your book.
Yes, well, it was a hard act to follow those first three or four six highly successful albums, Close to the Edge and Fragile, and everybody loved those albums, including me. I thought they were wonderful, and I hardly had a word to say. When it reached to Topographic Oceans, it was too neurotic for me. It always sounded like it was very tense and neurotic, and they were trying to be experimental to the point where it was no longer reaching the audience, I don't think. Well, it wasn't reaching me very well. And I did go and see it live. And gradually over the years, listening to it again and trying to adjust to it. But it wasn't the kind of the nice sort of mixture of great guitar solos, great musicianship and great songwriting that I really liked. I think it was just too experimental for me, for my taste anyway. And I remember going to see Chris and John backstage at the Rainbow Theatre after they finished playing Close to the Edge to Topographic Oceans. And they said they had planned to put a bucket of water on a rope on the door as I opened the door.
So yes,
the bucket would fall on my head. You know?
Yeah, you talked about that. Yeah,
yeah, I think I mentioned that, yeah. There was no bucket. But they took it very well, actually. Yeah, they were very good about it, you know. They weren't angry. They were still friends. But I just had to say what I thought. You know, I just didn't move me like the other music did. The
previous albums had done. And if you're going to keep your integrity as a journalist, you know, you're going to say, look, this is what I like, or this is not what I like. You're not just going to throw false, feigned praise on it just because they're your mates, you know?
That's true. Yes. Yes. You have to remember you're writing also, other journalists are reading what you're writing. You don't want to sound like a mouthpiece or a free publicist. You know? We do have standards, we journalists. You know?
You do. So moving towards your kind of association with McCartney, can you tell us a little bit about your association with, because I know you covered some of the early Wings tours. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those concerts you attended, and where were they, and what tours were they, if you happen to recall?
Yes, I was very lucky with Wings, actually. I probably got to know them as well as I did Yes at one point. They were very friendly. Paul was very friendly and helpful, and Linda as well. And what happened was, well, I'd seen the Beatles play, and then and I bumped into Paul maybe at parties and that sort of thing. But then, amazingly, when he was setting up Wings, and it was a big battle for him, because the press, the national press in particular, were all determined to try and force him into, when are you going to reform the Beatles? As you know, it's like an endless problem. Oh, yeah. He couldn't get away from it. It was just driving him nuts, really. And he tried to explain many times why they broke up. And he just didn't want to. He needed, I mean, as a musician, a songwriter, he had to carry on working. And Linda, his wife, was a tremendous help in encouraging him to form a new band, form a group. That's what he had to do. First of all, they went to Scotland to recuperate and think about music. Yeah. I remember, I think I said in my book, actually, I was just reading it today, that Paul had two great allies. And one was Linda, and the other was a blank piece of paper. Mm. So he could write on the paper a song and write a hit any time he chose.
Right.
So that was rather a nice balancing thing, I think. And what happened was he came up with this idea of having his own band, and he wanted to do a tour, but without all the aggravation of jumping through hoops at the Royal Albert Hall. So he did that college tour, which you probably know all about, which I didn't actually see, but a colleague went to see it, Chris Charlesworth, and he said it was great. They were really good, great band. It was coming together, and everybody was, the real fans, the audiences, appreciated what he was doing. Certainly the national press kept thinking, well, why is he needing to do this? Is he looking to make some more money, or why can't he get the Beatles back together? That wasn't the reason at all. It was to be satisfy his need to be, a vehicle for his musicianship. So, anyway, much to my surprise, probably because I've been writing about so many bands like Yes and encouraging them, and Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin, and who I saw playing to 50 people their first show.
Wow.
So I could tell you about them later. I think Paul realised that I would be a champion of Wings if he came up to see me at the office. I didn't have to go and see him, which was quite extraordinary now thinking back how it all came together. And our office was in Fleet Street, just an open plan office, and a few old radiators lying about, and not very grand at all. Back issues of the MM, and a picture of Marsha Hunt on the wall. Do you remember Marsha Hunt? And Miles Davis. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's it. So that's our office. And lo and behold, Paul McCartney arrived at lunchtime with Linda and a baby. They had a baby with them. It was a family. Well, it was near Christmas. It was December 73, coming up to Christmas. And the strange thing was, I felt like Paul was an old friend. He was talking like an old friend. Isn't that strange? Wasn't put on at all. Because you knew him so well from everything, the whole Beatles thing. And he was so outgoing and friendly and helpful and kind and generous, I'd say. All those plaudits, really. He's just like a mate. He wasn't putting on airs or graces or being difficult at all. And he sat and was very frank about lots of things, about the Beatles and about their manager. I was quite surprised, really. And he says it all casually, with hardly me. I hardly had to ask him any of those questions. So,
So, well, he probably assumed that you were going to ask anyways. So.
Well, yes, yeah, he knew what I was going to say, I guess. Mm. Yes, that's right. Yeah. But I was in awe of him, to be honest, yeah, as you would be. Mm-hmm. Presence of a beetle. But he got many things, and he was great. And the funny thing was, of course, I did ask Linda a few questions, but she was busy trying to stop Stella. Whoops. She was trying to stop Stella, the baby. They'd given the baby some crayons to draw with on paper. And we discovered that Stella was drawing all over the office walls, scribble, like graffiti. We should have kept it. It would have been Stella McCartney's graffiti when she was...
There you go, yeah.
But, yeah, and he told me about going to Africa. They'd been to Africa, I think, with Wings. And, yeah. Right. What a tough time they had there. They were mugged there, apparently.
Did you know about that?
And he told me about how he collapsed in the studio. And Linda thought he'd almost died. So, yeah, that's really what he was telling me about. But then I went to see them play. I actually went to see Wings play in, on tour. I was invited to go on tour.
So that 75 tour, then, I mean, you actually, did you just, were you just on like a couple day stint, or were you able to travel for most of that tour?
Well, I wasn't entirely sure what happened, really. Tony Bransby of their PR, I said, well, come down to Bristol, see the band. I think they're going to check me out and see if I was a good company or not. And so I went to Bristol, and they had a hotel, and I went to the hotel, and they booked all the rooms for the road crew. They pinched all the rooms, so there was no room for me. So they got me another hotel somewhere else, about a few miles away in Bristol, which I didn't know very well. But I was too busy anyway, worrying about hotels, to try and get to see Paul Bain and do an interview, because he was very busy setting it all up for the show, which I went to see, of course. And and it was great. I was invited to the backstage to see them rehearsing, and that was fun, watching Linda setting up her keyboards and Jimmy was the guitar player, of course, at that point.
Right.
I think it was Jimmy. Yes, it was, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah,
there have been a few changes in the band over the years. But but mainly I was talking to Paul and Linda. And
was this the opening of the tour, Chris? Or was it already... Because the tour opened on the 9th of September of 75 at the Galmont Cinema in... Oh, I forget where it was.
In London?
Yes. When you joined these shows, was it the start of the tour? Or had it already been going on for a bit?
It had been going, from my memory. Yeah, I think, well, it was Bristol down. As I say, I did see the Bristol show. And then I was invited to go with them in the Rolls-Royce, amazingly. So I was sitting in a Rolls-Royce with Paul McCartney and Linda. So that was before that, actually, the night before, it had been a nightmare because they had a film show in the hotel they were staying in. They took their own mobile cinema with them, as you do. And I forget what we were watching. Blazing Saddles was one of the films that we watched.
Nice.
So we stayed up till 2 in the morning watching movies. And I thought, oh, my God, I better get back to my hotel, which is some way across town. And I got there and it was locked and they wouldn't let me in, although I had a room booked. And at 2 in the morning, I was stranded in Bristol. So, God, went back to the Wings Hotel. No rooms at all, so I just lay on the sofa. And then security came and threatened to have me thrown out and call the police. I stayed until about 8 in the morning and then finally went back to my hotel and then got to sleep. So when I woke up, I was like death. I didn't want to go anywhere. I wanted to go home, actually.
I want to read to you what you wrote there in your Melody Maker article. And you wrote, a Wings concert is everything that a true pop concert should be. You know, talk about that and a little bit, your feelings about that and, you know, what excited you about, you know, that show.
Yes, well, the band were always much better than the national press would have us believe. They were rehearsing a lot and they were very exciting. Yeah, they were doing some great numbers, mixing one or two Beatles songs, as I recall, and all the material from their new albums. And I really enjoyed it. I thought that they sounded like a really exciting rock band, you know, different, you know, with keyboards. And Paul was really going for it. And Yeah, it was a convincing real band, you know, and despite the fact that every time when they finish the show, they get a review in the paper saying, when's Paul going to reform the Beatles? So that was very frustrating for him. He got quite angry. But yeah, thinking back, it was, they were a good, great band, good club band, dare I say. That's how it started out. And I think that's what Paul wanted. He wanted a real life rock and roll, not a rock and roll band, a good life. British rock band, almost a progressive rock band, I suppose you could say.
Certain parts of their repertoire could be a little bit heavier and proggier, certain aspects of some of the Wings music, some of it for sure. I would agree with that.
Yes, it's remembering the set list now is difficult for me, so I'll have to leave you to do that.
Yeah, well, it was like Venus and Mars and
Band on the Run.
That's it. Band on the Run.
Yes. Yeah. They had a lot of from that, and then not too much from earlier albums. You know, My Love was in there, but a lot from Band on the Run and Venus and Mars at that time.
Yeah, I did make notes, but I've now forgotten them all. But yes, it was.
Chris, you made an observation I'd like to ask your opinion on. And when I lived in the UK about a decade ago for graduate school, I wrote a thesis. Basically, I felt that the UK music journalists, by a whole, unfairly painted Paul as the villain because he was the one who dissolved the Beatles legally and did not give his solo music or Wings a fair crack. Do you agree with that theory? You know, that thesis, or no?
Well, Paul was quite open with me talking about why the Beatles broke up and why he took the action that he did. Yes, it was mainly to do with the American manager, Alan Klein, really.
Alan Klein, yeah.
We blame him for the breakup, really. He said that they all ceased I don't remember him saying to me that they all ceased to be friends for a while. You know, they'd been together so long through so much stress, and then... he said we weren't mates anymore. You know, they wanted to do their own different things. He called John up and he wouldn't take his calls, things like that, you know. Or Ringo wanted to leave the Beatles anyway, or George would get cross about things, about not having his songs taken for, you know, evaluated properly. So there was tension, and I suppose he took the final step. I think he said, didn't he, that John Lennon actually said the Beatles had broken up first, privately.
Yeah. Yep.
So once he said that, then Paul said, all right, okay, then, having seen these contracts that are being drawn up, all these financial shenanigans going on, then I'll leave the band, you know, I'm going to leave it. But the only way to actually physically break it up was to go to court, because they'd all signed contracts, hadn't they, I think. The other three had signed contracts with Alan Klein, and he wasn't going to do that. So that was really what led to the court thing. It may have upset the fans who didn't really understand or know what was going on in the background. Let's face it, most of us didn't know really until Paul actually told us.
Right.
Then we found out. But it was, it's happened to so many bands actually. Lots of bands ended that way. But of course, the Beatles weren't just any band, they were a worldwide phenomenon. So whatever happened to them, it's very important. But I think it was unfair to blame him for it really. But although he always took firm action, I think, taking firm action in forming Wings. You know, he's very positive about his career and his life and his music. So I don't think that's being bossy or overweening pride or anything like that. I think it's just somebody practical and sensible doing the right thing. That's my opinion.
Right. Oh, good. You know, he had so much more success in the States during the 70s, and then in the 80s, it kind of switched to having more success in the UK. I mean, can you give us the vibe of McCartney through other journalists or fans throughout the 70s in the UK, and as to why maybe he didn't have as much success in the UK as he did in the 70s? I mean, except for Mullet and Tyre. I mean, he only had one number one hit in the 70s in the UK, you know, which ended up...
Yeah. It's true that the music scene in Britain, of course, changed drastically, didn't it, in the late 70s. We had pub rock and punk rock, and the music that Paul was playing suddenly seemed rather dated and feeble in comparison to what we were listening from the Sex Pistols. And the whole revolution in music was going on, and lots of other revolutions along the way. So suddenly his kind of appeal faded a bit, I think. It was more difficult for him to get hit records. I mean, he still had his huge fan base, of course, and he made some great albums, successful albums, selling 5 million copies. That can't be bad, can it, really? But, I think he's found it more and more difficult to fit into the mood of the country. Britain has this habit of dropping everybody, moving on very rapidly into another sphere of music. Well, it's the generational thing as well, of course. You know, each new generation wants its own music, so it may be the Police, you know, coming along.
True.
So how do you combat with that? Well, it happened to all the progressive rock bands. They were all suddenly out of date overnight.
Yeah.
We're talking about them now. It's fantastic, but in 1980 or 79, they were all terribly yesterday's heroes, weren't they?
Which is sad. You know, think about it. You know, so there's certain acts, just, you know, ELP, Genesis, although they maintained and became even bigger in the 80s. Yes. They're the lone exception, but
I didn't dare mention that I like Genesis or Emerson, Lake and Palmer for a long time in public. You know,
I like the most of them. You can do that here.
Yeah,
you can say that all you want here, because we love Genesis as well here. So.
Yeah, it did get to that point. Or Moody Blues, for that matter. But now, of course, thanks to people like your good self, the world appreciates this music so much better, so much more for how good it was. It was great.
When did you decide to actually put the book together? Were you commissioned to write it, or you just had the idea to say, I'm going to write this?
I think I was commissioned. Yes, it was the publisher came to me. They knew I'd interviewed Paul and been on the road with them, and they wanted to do a book on Paul. And I thought it was, at the time I was a little slightly embarrassed about calling it the definitive biography, but that was their choice. And I did the best I could. You know, I had all the interview material, and I did more interviews.
Right.
Funnily enough, one of the best was with their drummer, actually.
Yes, we're going to get to that in a second. However, you know, before you write your book, I mean, there's not a lot of stuff out there on Paul. I mean, we got these two little, books here, prior to, but there was really no, you know, big definitive, if you will, you know, bio on Paul yet at that point in time.
No, that was the first, I think. It was the first, I wrote the first rock book, actually. Jimi Hendrix, but that's going back a bit. That was 10 years before. But yes, I'm surprised, like you. I don't, it's surprising there wasn't more about Wings, actually. But that was the first, isn't it?
Gotcha. Interviewing.
Talk about your approach. You know, obviously. Interviewing, you know, Jeff Britton, obviously. You know, Jeff Britton, obviously, that's a big score right there. I mean, obviously, his role there was the shortest of any of the band members. But I mean, he didn't pull any punches in that in your interview with him either. Mm. So, I mean, that was a big score.
It was, actually. I was surprised, really, how eloquent he was. And he could see into the... You could see all the faults, his own faults, and what was going on in the band, and why he said the chemistry wasn't right, actually. And I think he talked to me about the fact that there were all these different personalities, like Jimmy was a little feisty, bad-tempered Scotsman, and there was Denny Lane, and there was this north-south divide thing, Londoners and Birmingham people.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the personalities just didn't work, really, which is tragic, because they're all good, they're all... I think what happens with musicians is they want to sort of retain their own personality. And in his case, he was a karate expert. And he couldn't give up the fact that he was supposed to be a karate expert. So you should put that all to one side when you've got this opportunity of a lifetime. Just sink your own personality for a while. And, you know, accept that you're not the top dog. You know, you can't be the top dog. I think you're used to doing that in your own band. You can do that.
Yeah, I love the story he tells about, you know, yeah, at the audition, and, you know, Mitch Mitchell comes in from, you know, obviously from the Jimi Hendrix experience, and everybody's thinking, oh, this is, we're done, we're toast, yeah, you know, and then all of a sudden he just has a bad day, you know, and doesn't get the gig.
Yeah, I remember that now. Yes, he said he couldn't keep time, and he was not playing at all well. Yeah, tragic.
Really. Right.
Well. Right. I suppose Mitch was still recovering from what happened with Jimmy, really. He never really recovered, I don't think.
No.
Yeah. Interesting. You know, other people you got to talk to, do you remember other people you interviewed for the book?
Not especially, not directly. No, I didn't interview Jimmy, which is a shame. I don't know why, because I knew Jimmy from the Thunderclap Newman days, you know, and...
Yeah,
he was in that band. That was,
he died in 79, so probably wouldn't have the opportunity. But did you reach out to other members, say like Denny Lane or Denny Sywell? Did you try reaching out to other band members?
I should have done. I don't know why I didn't in that case. Yeah, because I know Denny Lane. I knew Denny Lane very well, but why I didn't actually interview? Yeah.
I figured you might have well have ran into Denny Lane, obviously, you know, with his early Moody Blues days. I'm sure.
Yes, I knew Denny from then, yeah, and his own band, the Electric Band. What was it called?
The Electric String Band.
The Electric String Band, which I saw at the Speakeasy Club, yeah. I interviewed Denny again not so long ago, actually, in Las Vegas for a Moody Blues documentary. And, we sat in the Red Desert. That was fun.
Yeah. Wow. Oh, was that the classic artist, Moody Blues?
That's the one. Yeah.
Yeah. Good job on that one. That's a great, and you know, well, I'll talk about that at the end, because if you have never seen those classic artist documentaries that they, those are wonderful documentaries that are really all encompassing, that cover the band's history really well. Chris mentions the ones on the Moody Blues. You can see him a fair amount in this documentary here, the classic artist. Yes. Documentary. Yes. Chris is in this a bunch. Talking about, you know, yes. So you had mentioned the Denny Lane and that the Moody Blues classic artist is the, you know, the film company that produces it. But there's Moody Blues. Yes, I'm sure there's more too, Chris, aren't there?
Cream was the one I enjoyed doing the most, actually, as well as Yes. But shall I tell you about that? That was fun.
Please.
We did, because Cream, against all odds, suddenly decided to reunite and do their last shows together. And I saw them at the Royal Albert Hall, which was, funnily enough, where we saw Yes and Cream back in 68. There they were playing again together. And I interviewed Eric, Jack and Ginger. And cool. Jack and Ginger were still arguing. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, but I was very lucky. I wrote the program notes and... And then I was invited to New York to see them play at Madison Square, which was fantastic. Yeah. Really. And they're all staying in different hotels, I think. And I heard from the management that already the rowing had begun between Jack and Ginger, which was a shame.
Yeah. Right.
But the funny thing is, I interviewed Ginger and he said, Jack, he's too loud. He's driving me mad, he said. And he had a cage built around him, a glass screen built around the drum. So he couldn't hear Jack Bruce's bass guitar. Well, he had tinnitus, so that's the reason.
Gotcha.
But it was
the going back to the Paul book, you really, if you didn't know anything about Paul in, let's say, the mid-80s, if you wanted to read about it and then read your book, you really talk highly of the family aspect of Paul, and so does he. You know, he loves the fact that it's, you know, a family band for the most part. They travel with the kids, you know, and all that. So I thought that was, you did a great job, you know, hitting that point that, you know, his family means everything to him.
They did, and yes, very much so. And yes, I was very lucky that I did speak to Linda. We did a nice interview, which, strangely enough, was repeated, syndicated in Australia, I discovered. For a women's magazine in Australia, and also a magazine called Wedding in the UK. Mm-hmm. And they syndicated my interview with Linda, which was rather nice. And Paul rang me up and said, did Linda do this interview with Wedding magazine? I said, no, that's my interview, don't worry. So he was just checking up. He sneaked off and done another interview on her own, you see. That's in it, it's my interview. We did on the road, and she was lovely. Yeah, she was a really nice person, and it was great to see a real family That's what Paul wanted to do, have it as a family affair. Right. Because bands often, you know, they leave their families behind for months on end touring, and that causes so much distress and heartbreak and broken marriages and that sort of thing. The girlfriend or wife's back home and not knowing what the lead guitar player is doing. Right. In Tokyo, you know.
Right.
So, yeah, he wanted to make sure. And that was the whole idea of Wings, I think, to make it a family. So it's a shame that there should be rows among the musicians, not between Linda and Paul.
Right.
Sorry, blackout. I'm being blacked out.
That's all right. We still see you.
Yeah, I think your point, Tom, you know, about Wings being a family, I think that's was true. Yeah. And,
There's a lot of there's been a lot of chat. I'm curious your opinion on this, Chris, where Wings, you know, should be they considered as one band being inducted into as a Hall of Fame, or were they just basically backing musicians for Paul's, you know, what he wanted to do? You know, I know he wanted to project the idea of Wings being a bona fide band, but I think time has shown us that really it was Paul was really going to be pulling the strings. I mean, he wanted the band to be what it, you know, he wanted to channel what the Beatles did coming up again by playing unknown clubs and traveling, and but you know when you're already established as Paul McCartney, it's really hard to separate that. So, you know, tell us what your thoughts are about that identity, that Wings as a band, or just being backing for, you know, Paul.
Well, I think Paul really liked the idea, as I said earlier, of forming a band, going out on the road. He wanted to do a tour of small pubs with the Beatles, actually, at one point, I remember him saying. And they all said he was mad, you know, you're crazy, right. Can't do that. But that would have been a nice idea if they could have gone back to their roots and just done a little club tour. And that's what I think he had in mind for Wings. But of course, as their drummer pointed out later, he was the boss. He was the man in charge. And it wasn't a sort of, it wasn't like Yes, where everybody contributes equally to the music. I mean, every member of Yes had a major contribution to make, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's on bass guitar, drums, or vocals, or songwriting, or whatever. So they all had equal input, or at least that's how they saw it. So, but with Wings, that wasn't the issue. That didn't really happen, I don't think. I think that was probably a cause of upset, like the guitar player, Jimmy might have felt he didn't get enough space. The drummer certainly felt. I don't think the drummer actually, their second drummer, Jeff, I don't think he actually played a gig with him. Yeah.
No, didn't.
Never played live with him. He blew it before that.
He did.
So, so I'm thinking about the difference and what the ambition was for Paul. And because when they did that last album in Africa, he actually played the drums on it. Just the three of them, just Linda, Denny, and Paul. And Paul could play the bass and the drums and everything else. So he was ahead of his time, really, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely.
He could have been a one-man band. Like.
He was ahead of his time back in 1970 when he did everything on his own and for a first record.
It is interesting, the parallels between Yes and, say, Paul McCartney. Have you ever heard that clip of Bill Bruford talking about how Yes was a completely, entirely democratic organization to a fault? You know, they all sit around for hours discussing whether the next bass note should be an F or an F sharp for days.
Yes.
You know? So it totally, yeah. So you could see why somebody like Bill just had to go. You know, he couldn't stand for that much longer.
Yeah, I went to one of the Yes recording sessions at Vision Studios, and and I remember Bill saying, "What does total mass retain mean?" And he couldn't understand. He's getting quite cross about that.
Yeah, it means crap.
He wasn't afraid of expressing his opinion, Bill. Yeah.
So, no, he did not, and he quickly departed and went to join
Crimson
after that. One final Yes question for me. Were you at the gig where Sly and the Family Stone famously did not turn up, but then Yes was called to play because Sly didn't show up and Yes played? Were you there that night?
I remember. Well, I heard about that night. My colleague Tony Wilson, a melody maker, a journalist who later retired or left. He was there, I think. Yeah, he saw that gig. And I missed that one. And funnily enough, I actually saw Sly and the Family Stone instead, playing it another time. How ironic. Everybody's playing Sly and the Family Stone. They were playing it at another club around the corner in Piccadilly. because they had the habit of totally disorganizing. You never knew if they were going to turn up or not.
Yeah,
but by a miracle, I actually saw them play live. And I think it's Park Lane, a club in Park Lane. Yeah. But I didn't see them with the gig where Yes actually took over. Well, I wouldn't have seen
them. Right, right. But that's another way, another great way how they got their start, you know, to do that. Tom, you got any final questions?
Yeah, you spoke pretty highly of McCartney, too, in the book. You seemed like you were a big fan of the three singles, Waterfalls, Temporary Secretary, and Coming Up.
I did like Temporary Secretary and Coming Up very much. Yes, I thought that was a new direction for Paul. A very powerful piece, I thought. Dynamic and exciting as well. So that could have been good direction for Wings to take. Yeah. So
what did you what did you think of? I mean, obviously the book ends at Pipes of Peace. What were your thoughts on Tug of War and Pipes of Peace as he's, you know, not a band anymore? He's just hiring hands now to you know, help him with his album.
Yes, well, they were huge hits, weren't they? Very successful. I didn't get into the music as much as I should have done. I didn't feel that it was something, because I'm a kind of a band person, you know. No, I can't really talk too much about that, to be honest, Tom. Yeah, it's I should have listened to the albums again today, but I haven't. So
that's fine.
Well, he obviously the band concept had ended, right? Wings had ended, and Paul, in the wake of John's death, he kind of really reinvigorates his career by doing these duos with Michael Jackson and Stevie Wonder, and you know, that period there in the early '80s, which Tom's talking about. Funnily enough, those, you know, they did very well in the UK. You know,
they did, yes. It reinvigorated his career, and it's great stuff. I think he'd sort of shed his wings then and was flying on his own, wasn't he?
There you go, that's a good point. Just a couple two last things, real quick. You write a bio on his career so early, and then he's still, you know, going, you know, 35, 40 years after. I mean, have you followed his career, continue to follow his career up to this point?
Well, I wasn't so close to Paul afterwards. I made a rather foolish error, actually. I went to see the Wings playing at the place called the Earl's Court. I think it was a big big venue in London. And I didn't like it because they were using lighting effects. It was very loud. You felt remote from the actual band. And I was used to being close up to the band, to Wings. It all seemed rather remote and theatrical. It was going the way of so many bands did at that time, where you can, you're sort of a half a mile away from the action. You're not really engaging with the music in the way you should be. Nice. Light shows and stuff. And I wrote this review as if I was a club secretary booking the band and saying, I wasn't too rude about it, but it wasn't a great review. And I said, I suppose Paul will be playing yesterday forevermore. And Linda wasn't happy about that. So she was very upset, apparently.
That must have been the 79 tour then, I guess.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I just didn't like the way that it had all become too big and monstrous and a giant. It's like when you go to see your favorite band playing at Madison Square, and it's not the same as when you saw them in a bath. You know, it's that kind of feeling.
Yeah. Well, it's very much like your review of Topographic Oceans. You know, if you don't like, you know, if they expect you to throw praise on everything, that's not what your job is.
That's true, Andy. Yes, that's right. Yeah. I was hoping they'd understand that, but I don't think they're
I think to think that time heals all wounds. Obviously, you know, you got together. John and Chris had no issue with it, and I'm sure Paul, I'm sure it's all long past water under the bridge for Macca now.
Yes, I think so. I did see him again after that piece I wrote, and he called me a few names and then laughed. So that was it.
Nice.
I don't mind. I don't mind, but Linda didn't like it at all. I do manage to upset people occasionally.
Well, I mean, it's going to happen from time to time, right? Like Andy said, if you don't like something, you shouldn't be shy about saying it. Absolutely. In the late 80s, I became a pretty big, you know, fan of heavy metal, and you had then switched to Kerrang! Magazine, right? And wrote a lot about a lot of heavy metal acts. I mean, Can you talk about some of your favorites?
Yes, I did. Yes, that was interesting period in my life. Left me with tinnitus, actually. I don't think bands could get any louder than ELP. They can.
Right.
No, I love working for Crank. It's a great magazine. It's incredible, really. Mm-hmm. It started out as a monthly, and heavy metal was taking off in Britain so far, and in the States, of course, and Germany as well, because it was live rock music, and it was down to earth and experimental at the same time. Fascinating when you think about it. I like Megadeth. I thought they were incredible.
Oh, yeah.
Very
still, they're still putting out new music. Good stuff.
That's Megadeth crying out there. I went to Los Angeles to interview Megadeth, and I played their album. Who's Buying? That's the one, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, anyway, Sells Who's Buying. Yeah.
That's the one. And I was flying through turbulence to Los Angeles for hours listening to this album. And I arrived feeling totally shattered and not knowing how I'd be greeted by the band. But they're really nice people. Yeah. But so, I did cover a lot of heavy metal at that time.
Those
are very interesting, funny bands. Great.
Right.
I remember going to see Iron Maiden playing in San Francisco. And now, let me see. I'm trying to remember the support band now. It was Guns N' Roses was the support band.
Ah, okay.
And they dropped out the tour. They disappeared halfway through the tour. I don't think they liked Iron Maiden competition, you see.
Right.
But I was standing waiting for Iron Maiden to come on in the hall, and suddenly I was knocked flying by hundreds of kids who were charging across. I was caught in a mosh. I didn't know what it was.
The mosh pit. Yeah, it's amazing. A lot of these bands are still going. You know, last time Megadeth was here, I'm a chef, so I did a lot of catering for tours and stuff like that. So, you know, I got to meet, meet Dave Mustaine from Megadeth and Hetfield from Judas Priest. So that was, getting to meet, a lot of these people was pretty cool.
Dave Mustaine is great.
Yeah, he is. But
when I met him, Chris, shall I just briefly tell you about my meeting?
Yeah. Go ahead.
I said, we're all out in the car park. And I said, oh, okay, we'll do the interview out there. And he just got a brand new car. It's a huge, I think it was a Mustang or a Ferrari, and a fantastic new car I just bought. And said, do you want to drive? And, we'll go for a ride. I said, no, you drive. And I was driving around Hollywood, no license in this driving van.
No license. Whoa.
Yeah. And in the opposite seat.
But it's starting to look a bit worried. I could actually drive it, but it's incredible.
Cool.
Anyway, that's my Megadeth story. Yeah.
Wow, Tom, you got anything else?
Go
ahead, Chris.
On that tour, I interviewed Ozzy Osbourne.
Yeah.
Sharon said we've got to get Ozzy in shape for this tour, and he's in terrible shape, and we don't know what to do, and we were staying at the Sunset Marquee Hotel, and somebody said, you should take him to the gymnasium. We have a gym. And so Sharon forced him to go to this gymnasium, and he had to do all these press-ups and exercises to get ready for the tour. And he started groaning and making terrible, horrible noises. We were taking photographs of him. And the gym instructor said, anybody think we were torturing you? He said, you are. Rolling
that's amazing. You definitely have lived quite an extraordinary life and got to meet a lot of amazing people. Mm. And we really appreciate you taking the time and talking about some of your, your adventures. Are you working on anything? Anything you want to plug?
I just did the book on Keith Emerson called Emerson. I don't know if you've seen that yet.
I have not. Wow.
It's just out now. Yeah. It came out in November, actually. Yeah.
Okay.
I interviewed Greg and Carl and his family, and it was all with the family's approval. So.
Oh, fantastic! What a welcome biography for such a great musician.
If I could find it in my study, I could show it to you. I've got this in somewhere.
No.
I don't know where I put it. But it's, yes, that's the last thing I did. That's the last one.
Incredible. Wow. Wow, that's great. And if you have not listened to ELP, give them a play on Pictures at an Exhibition. Just incredible music.
Yeah.
Oh, from the early 70s. And, of course, this period with the Nice, obviously, in the late 60s, I'm sure, is very interesting time period to look at. Chris, how can people get a hold of you? You have your website, right, as well? Do you want to tell everybody?
Yes, it's Chris Welch Online. That's it, I think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we'll have it in the description box below here. You can just follow that link, and that'll take you to Chris's website. Wonderful website. Some fantastic. He's got snippets of all his pieces that he's written from the 60s and the 70s mm-hmm. and his Melody Maker days. That wonderful photo of him and Keith at the pub.
Wonderful.
It's a great website. What a celebrated life. Chris, we are so honored and moved that you could give us a little bit of your time tonight to talk about your work experience, your career, your work following Yes, and your book on Paul McCartney that you published in 1984. If anybody is any pop music fan from the 60s and 70s, you know the name Chris Welch. You might have read the articles. Even if you're a Yank like us, you'll know who Chris Welch is. He is a fantastic writer. Again, he's in numerous documentaries, classic artist, Yes. He wrote the definitive book on Yes, Close to the Edge, the story of Yes, republished in 2003 with an update. And everything is on his website. And Chris, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Well, it's a pleasure, and Tom, thank you so much for talking to me and all your kind words. It's very, very much appreciated. And I enjoyed that conversation. And I'm sorry I couldn't remember all the set lists, but that's
well, that's no the worries. Beauty of the internet, no Chris. We can just look it up, right. You know? We can always just look it up. But
sure thing.
For Tom, for Chris, I'm Andy. This has been one special episode of Two Legs, and we are so happy that he joined us. Thank you so much, everybody, for watching tonight, and we'll see you next time.
Look forward to seeing you all. Cheers. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast, hosted by Tom Hunyadi and Andy Nichols, with musical contributions by Dylan C.